It's Wednesday, March 6, 2019, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me, as always, are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, we're going to talk about the Momo Challenge. Even after it was proven to be a hoax, television stations across the country continued reporting on it heavily. It feels like it happened a lifetime ago, but it was just last week that President Trump was in Vietnam meeting with Kim Jong-un. We'll talk about the summit, the coverage, and the North Korean leaders' answers to American journalists' questions. And leaving Netherland, now Neverland, now that it's run in its entirety on HBO, I'll ask Mike and Ernest what the long-term impact of this film is likely to be. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well, but I want to start by talking about another documentary and the backlash against it. It really started Sunday night at a screening here in town at the True False Film Festival. The Commons is an eyewitness's take of what happened in Chapel Hill as students toppled the controversial Silent Sam statue on the University of North Carolina's campus. Take a listen to a short excerpt from the film's trailer.
Nazis go home! Nazis go home!
Shame
Nazis,
you're
not Nazis.
We're not Nazis,
you're,
sir.
Yeah, you're not.
We hate you. We want you to go
yes,
home.
Yes, you do. You hate us. You hate us.
You're not a Nazi, sir.
Yeah, you
we
are.
We don't hate you.
You don't even know what a
shame
Nazi
on your
is.
Ideas.
Who do you protect? Who do you serve? Who do you protect? Who do you serve? Who do you protect? Who do you serve?
Who do you serve?
And I have also been harassed. I have been called a I have been told that I will be hung from the tree right above Silent Sam.
Don't even do anything!
It screened four times during the festival, and before the final screening Sunday evening, True False organizers told the audience that there were going to be some uncomfortable moments to come. Sure, there were those during the film, the ones that everyone had expected, but it was what happened during the Q&A with the filmmakers that few were prepared for. Several of the students who appeared in the film were there to take on the husband and wife team who made it and ask how it was possible that they had become so heavily featured in the documentary and didn't know it until the film started screening this weekend. Their remarks were streamed on Facebook Live. Here's part of what was said.
By filming us without our consent, you contribute to the violent history of state surveillance of Black people and people of color. You contribute to the traumatic legacy of white people studying us for science and their own games. Your art, like the University of North Carolina, was built on our backs. And to this we say, nothing about us, without us, is for us.
Nothing without us. So people who were in the audience said there was a really good discussion that followed and talking really about the importance of diversifying both the production methods in documentary film and in journalism as a whole.
I think that part is important. I think it is beneficial to have some diversity in it because If the filmmakers had had that, there would have been more of a discussion about the representation of it, getting all sides involved in the content of that. Because I think what they were complaining about, and I'm talking about those who came from North Carolina mm-hmm. who were
students,
in the film,
the students. Student activists, yeah.
I think that what they were concerned about was the fact that they had not been interviewed. That they had not been spoken to. Their images were there. What they said in an open forum in a public place was there, but it did not have their narrative, their contextual story connected to it so that you could have probably a more thorough understanding of why they were out there.
I mean, I did not see the film. I saw several at True False. I was not one of them, so my loss. I can't comment on the film itself. I will say that I think that if they felt like they were featured in the film and there was no contact between the filmmakers and them, that's a legitimate concern. On the other hand, if there do, there are lots of documentaries that do not involve interviewing the subjects. They use archival footage, or they're just, as these filmmakers said, we wanted to be in the middle of it and just to show you what that situation was like. They certainly had the right to be there in a public place and film people protesting in a public place. The filmmakers made the case, and I don't know if this is true, again, because I haven't seen it, that their job, they were not trying to have central characters in their documentary. They just wanted to show you from the perspective of somebody in the middle of it observing what it was like and to try to be as balanced as they could. I don't know if they achieved that or not. I do think, though, that there is this question. The reason this whole thing comes up in the first place is that you have two white filmmakers doing a film about mostly black student protesters, and whether or not their images were being appropriated, their ideas were being appropriately reflected in the documentary. Those are really tough questions, because documentaries don't have the same set of principles and ethics and guidelines that straightforward journalism does.
And I think that may be part of the issue here, is that, you know, you have the filmmakers who they have an intent of what it is that they're trying to do, and Mike did a very good job of describing that. But then
there's a specific intended point of view.
Intended point of view. And when you put that out there, you open yourself up to these kinds of criticisms, and you're starting to see that play out in more and more public ways. I mean, you know, in the past, you would see letters to the editor, or people would write comments and stories and that sort of thing. But now they will show up at screenings like this. They will flood social media. They would do all these other things that sort of gets into this back and forth, sort of argumentative kind of environment that really does inhibits the ability to be able to actually sit down and have dialogue. Because what I didn't see there in that clip that you said, I haven't seen much in the social media back and forth, is an actual dialogue about Silent Sam, what Silent Sam means, what both sides have to say about that, how did it lead to this point. That's something
that
I haven't seen.
This stopped being about Silent Sam.
Yeah.
This is now about decolonizing documentaries. This is about shutting down screenings of what is ultimately a piece of art, which could also be seen as a violation of the First Amendment that we sometimes think of as being something that's always coming from the right, and it's actually coming from the left in this situation.
It's interesting, too. Let's draw a comparison between this and our own student protests from a few years back. We actually had, as far as I know, no interest in sort of observational documentaries being done about this from a sort of a traditional standpoint. We did have a team of students from our school of journalism who were interested in working with the student protest leaders and showing their lived lives as this whole thing was playing out. None of those students was African American either, but they clearly were sympathetic to the students and showed, from the students' point of view, a more balanced
treatment. If I do remember, though, there was at least one student who was a person of color.
Yes, that's right.
Right.
But my point is, they weren't attempting to be balanced either. They were attempting to show a side of this protest and this movement that most other folks in the media were not going to show. Fair enough. Similarly, with the situation in Chapel Hill, among the students who came here to protest at True False, they had produced a film as well, which showed it from their point of view, and they felt it showed them doing more than simply being out there arguing with counter-protesters. So in some way, you can say in both instances, there were attempts to capture different points of view in different ways with these documentaries. And I will say, too, if we're talking about having a dialogue, it needs to be more than just people issuing statements out of concern for their image or whatever it was. True False issued a statement itself about this. The filmmakers issued a statement, and they were all looking for some balance between explaining what happened and apologizing if they were insensitive and looking forward to what might happen in the future. But statements are different than having an actual conversation. On the same hand, the students from North Carolina posted a video about them showing up, but they didn't show the full conversation. They only showed them reading their statement. That is also not a conversation.
And I think what people claim to be, you know, having dialogue or connecting with each other, it turns out to be these statements, and it turns out that everyone is trying to represent their particular point of view.
Or their interest.
Or their interest.
You know, True False doesn't want to be seen as colonizing documentary either. Each party in this case has a very specific interest to protect.
But that doesn't lead you to dialogue to where you can come to some sort of understanding of what the other side may think. Doesn't necessarily mean you may agree with them, but there has to be some sort of dialogue that leads to some kind of understanding.
I will say, too, that true-false, once they found out those students were there, they facilitated having that conversation at the end of that final screening. And I was at true-false, and there were at least three documentaries that they screened about problems with refugees and populations that were oppressed. There were fantastic films at true-false where people got to have conversations about that topic. So let's not take this one film and judge it as how true-false did or did not deal with the question.
So out of fairness then to true-false, are there any specific that you might want to talk about that you saw over the weekend that kind of serve as the exemplar in that case?
Well, for example, Midnight Traveler, which was about, you know, refugees leaving Afghanistan and going through the migration process in Europe. Fantastic documentary. Island of the Hungry Ghosts, which is about detainees that the Australian government was detaining on an island offshore and how they were mistreated. Fabulous documentary. There was another one called One Child Nation about the one child policy in China. Fabulous documentary. And there were many others that I didn't see. The folks at True False who program it look for these kinds of conversations and these kinds of stories to tell. So I'd give them credit for that.
Okay. Well, Sunday and Monday, HBO aired the four-hour documentary Leaving Neverland, the story of two of Michael Jackson's former companions who have come forward to discuss the nature of their relationships with him. James Safechuck and Wade Robson each testified on behalf of Jackson during the trials back in the 90s and early 2000s, but say now that they are adults and fathers themselves, they can't be silent about the abuse anymore. The film is graphic in its use of language and descriptions of behaviors. The Jackson family and those managing his estate have been vocal in their protests of the film, even threatening to sue HBO for running it. Hear now from the director, Dan Reed.
The Jackson estate, I believe, have not watched the film either. So I think it's true to say that the Jackson family and the estate don't know what they're talking about, because they haven't watched the film. How can you write a 10-page rebuttal of something that you haven't even watched? It's ridiculous. We've heard nothing at all. I mean, we've had, you know, the estate lawyers have written a letter and the Jackson family have made a statement, but we've had no direct contact from the family.
So I watched the first half of this Sunday night. After 2 hours of this one, after 6 hours of Surviving R. Kelly, I couldn't do the second half, but a lot of the film critics going back to the debut of Leaving Neverland back at Sundance said this film was really going to challenge people to change their relationship with their fandom of Michael Jackson.
I think it's going to challenge it, but now it's all thrown into the court of public opinion. And you have the director saying one thing, you have the family and the estate saying something else. The difference here between R. Kelly and Jussie Smollett and all that is that Michael Jackson is dead. Mm-hmm. And so he can't defend himself.
Or to bring Bill Cosby into that realm as well.
You can bring him to the realm. But, you know, Michael Jackson is dead. There were all these accusations when he was alive. There was the trial that turned out to basically acquit him. You know, so now you've got this film that comes out. And it speaks from the perspective of those who claim to be abused. I don't know where it's going to go from here because his image and his music is so powerful. I'm not sure whether or not this is something that will tarnish his image. It will do that, but I don't know if it's going to bring his image down.
I mean, several million people are going to see it on HBO. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm planning on watching it. But that's far fewer than the billions of people who have heard Michael Jackson's music, right?
Compare that to ticket sales for Thriller in 1980, whatever.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I will say, yes, he's dead. The family is denying it, but of course the family trust has a business interest in this too. They're about to launch a Broadway musical, which may or may not happen now as a result of all this conversation. That's millions of dollars in investments there. What's really different here is you have, I guess, if you believe the filmmaker and the victims, is that at least one of their mothers came forward because of the whole Me Too movement and thinking, you know, I have to own up to my responsibility for what I did. And really, this documentary is told only from the perspective of those two victims and their families. Right. They make very compelling cases from what I've heard, but there are no interviews with the police. There's no, you know, response from the family other than sort of the boilerplate stuff that they put in there. So it's seen from the viewpoint of those two victims. One's like now in his 30s and another is 41, I think it is. Right. The fact that they testified basically in favor of Michael Jackson in two
on
separate
his behalf
court
in
cases.
Different cases. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
You were about to say something.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to say that Monday night after the second installment, Oprah Winfrey also hosted a sit-down discussion with them, and she caught a lot of heat for having done so, especially among those fans of Michael Jackson who say that there's nothing in this documentary that is true, and that she too fell subject to the trolls, and she said she was going to be okay with it, and she was going to deal with it, and that the hateful attacks would come, and she felt like it was time to speak up. Don't read the comments. It's a cesspool, right? The worst of humanity. It doesn't have to be, though, and I've always been in that camp. But I've also said the key to making it work is a commitment toward putting human resources toward moderation so that there is an adult in the virtual room to maintain civility. That's why there was a piece that was in BuzzFeed yesterday that I found to be it immediately caught my eye because the headline said in there that among the most important people in a news organization right now is the comment moderator, and we need to make that person more prominent.
And that BuzzFeed story followed on a piece in The Verge a couple of days before that, where they basically followed these people who worked as human curators or moderators. By the way, Facebook, they don't have their own people doing this. Sometimes they hire out firms that pay people not very good wages, and they have them spend looking at hundreds or thousands a day of real or fake murders, suicides, hate speech, you name it, all kinds of just horrible stuff playing on there. What kind of job is that? And yet, as you say, if some humans are not curating this content, it's going to devolve into even worse things.
Yeah, I mean, you know, part of the problem I see with this is, you know, when the online and the social media, you know, first started out, there wasn't someone there moderating this. It was just out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just, and it's now all of a sudden the moderation is trying to put, it's almost like you're trying to put the genie back in the bottle. And so you have these people who are sitting there, you're right, they aren't paid a whole lot of money, and they're trying to filter through this and make sure that the conversation is somewhat civil. But then you also have sites out there that basically just put it all out there. And what's to differentiate one site from another site, one that's moderated and one that's not moderated, especially when everything seems to be so open. And I think this is the thing that scares parents more than anything else about their, you know, their kids starting to get
consume
on social media and consume
themselves.
This media, is that you don't know which ones are being moderated and which ones aren't. And then that gets out there, and there's just no way to pull that back in.
I mean, you know, there has been talk about technology, right? Algorithms that can police this stuff in real
time.
Well,
when Facebook was looking at that.
But we talked about this last week. Algorithms are programmed by human beings. And first of all, the human beings at Facebook, I mean, they can't agree on what hate speech is. The folks at YouTube can't seem to agree on what is a conspiracy video or what isn't.
And then you're getting into the flat earthers again.
And then you get challenged. You know, I mean, you know, you got Congress talking about, you know, well, the right is not getting its information out there because the left wing is in control of social media and this sort of thing. So, I mean, it's kind of hard to talk about moderation when you're getting challenged from all over about what is the thing to moderate.
And what happens when a traditional news organization decides to moderate comments and do a serious job of it, all of a sudden they get, you know, carpet bombed by Reddit or the people on 4chan or sending porn and violence and all kinds of other stuff just to overwhelm their comments.
Right.
Well, YouTube, as you bring that up, found itself in the middle of the Momo challenge, and it just keeps coming back. There were clips spliced into some videos on YouTube that was encouraging kids to commit suicide. Yes, that happened. But the Momo challenge, which gave children a series of instructions to carry out to commit self-harm or harm to others, no. That didn't happen. But that also didn't stop local television stations from reporting on it as though it did, and showing clips that had been proven to be a hoax more than a year ago. In some ways, what was going on, because some of these, there's a piece on our Links blog that kind of called out, there had to have been 24 different television stations that said, we know we're reporting on a hoax, let us tell you about it. It was like trying to prove a false narrative that perpetuated the problem.
I don't know if that was cynicism, stupidity, or both, but it was driven by ratings, in my opinion. It's just too good. The video's there. It also plays off of parental fears, and an awful lot of ratings period-based news content on television is to try to set up this fearful situation and then talk about what, if anything, could be done about it.
Culture of fear. There's a theory and an entire phenomenon around that.
I think Mike is absolutely right. This is all about trying to get your ratings up. Especially during sweeps, so that you can go to advertisers and say, here, these are the number of people that are watching. It does bring up fear, especially the fear in parents. I mean, parents are afraid of enough as it is, and then you throw this out there, and then all of a sudden, it's like game on. We've got to protect our kids from everything.
And now you've created this feedback loop because mm-hmm. you have parents who are upset about it because they see it on TV or whatever, social media. Mm-hmm. They spread it. Then police departments have to respond to it, and it just keeps going and going when, as you say, the primary story is a myth. It's a hoax. It isn't happening.
I mean, this is one of those stories where I think if the media would just stop.
Yeah.
Just stop playing it. Stop talking about it. Then it goes away.
Who needs misinformation from foreign agents when we can provide the misinformation ourselves?
That's right.
And speaking of misinformation, okay, maybe not speaking of it, but we didn't really get a chance to talk last week about what was going on in Hanoi during the second summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. So let's do that now. And as the kids say, it was a lot. There was this moment during a joint news conference when Trump and Kim were talking, and Kim took a question from a Washington Post reporter.
Thank you all very much.
Thanks, guys. Thank you,
guys. Thank you. Kim, are you confident?
Thanks, David.
Thank you guys very much.
Okay. But I wouldn't say that I'm
confident. From what I feel right now, I do have a feeling that good results will come.
Thank you.
So there was confidence there on both sides, yet Trump walked out of the negotiations and in some ways then used the death of Otto Warmbier and tried to stir emotions all over again, only to have that boomerang and hit him in the face.
I mean, in some ways, I mean, this is the reason why a lot of folks were saying, including people in his own government, to President Trump, you don't give the exposure to Kim Jong-un in a summit before you have something that you can really sign off on. When he basically answers that question, it's the first time he's answered a question to Western reporters. He looks like a president of a country that is negotiating with the United States
somewhat
in good
sensible.
Faith.
Yeah.
Right. And then, the president compounds that, our president compounds that by basically saying that, well, Otto Warmbier, that Kim Jong-un didn't really know what his own regime was doing to him before he comes home and dies a few months later, when just like last January, the president has Warmbier's parents there at the State of the Union speech trying to support them and tell them how brave they were and how it was terrible that the North Korean government had done this to him.
Yeah, it's almost as if, he's using the parents and he's using Otto Warmbier as a way to get in to talk to Kim Jong-un, and then he gets there and there's really nothing to talk about. And then when it comes back up, he wants to say, well, I believe what the leader is saying to me, as opposed to all of this evidence to the contrary, mm-hmm. and how he thinks that somehow is going to help him either with the North Koreans or with his own people, I don't know. The whole North Korea thing just baffles me because it is a form of foreign policy that I don't think we've ever seen from a U.S. president.
Okay, so we only have a couple more minutes. There are a couple of other political issues I want to run by both of you. Google Canada announced it's banning political ads ahead of the federal election in that company, figuring it's easier to just do away with them then comply with new laws that are in place.
And the new law basically from Canada says that you have to keep a registry, a log, of all political and partisan ads, who paid for them directly or indirectly. And Google just says, it would be cheaper for us not to comply, so we're just not going to allow any ads. And yet Google controls about 50% of all the online advertising in Canada. So candidates and people who are advocating for issues in Canada are going to have a platform they can't take advantage of anymore.
Yeah, they can't take advantage of the platform, but I'm also wondering how much money is being left on the table for that. I mean, that's an incredible amount of money. You're talking about a federal election in a major country.
Maybe this becomes a windfall then for Canadian television stations newspapers that they're going to want to advertise.
I will say at least the Canadian government decided that they wanted to do something about election interference, something our government
has not really done. Well, I also want to bring up a Montana bill that's actually been tabled for the time being, but still getting attention. It would require that media outlets owned by out-of-state corporations prominently identify owners on the front of print publications and on their online editions. The Montana Newspaper Association and Montana Broadcasters Association are strongly against this, claiming it's a violation of the First Amendment. The legislator who proposed it said this was in reaction to a television ownership group, I would presume Sinclair, requiring on-air personnel to read specific messages and must runs.
I think that's actually kind of interesting. And we should say, first of all, the committee that was hearing it tabled it on like an 18-2 vote or something
like that.
It's not coming up anymore this year, probably. But to have a Republican state legislator say, I'm doing this because I saw this whole Sinclair business and they're telling all their stations they have to run certain editorials. I don't want local papers that are owned by big conglomerates to have to do the same. I don't agree with the way that he's approaching it, but the question is really interesting.
I agree with you on that. I think the question is interesting. I don't agree with the approach, but to actually have a Republican come out and be the one that leading that effort, that was surprising to me. I mean, it may have had, you know, it may have had some pushback both from Republicans and Democrats, but I think if it would have been a bipartisan bill, they probably would have gotten more support.
And there are a lot of small town newspapers, community newspapers, all throughout the country, not just in Montana, that are owned by these big media conglomerates that are headquartered somewhere else. That doesn't mean that those local papers don't have control over their content, but it's clearly an interest in whether or not the community is being represented by people who live and care about the community, as opposed to financial interests that are in some other city someplace.
Yeah, I agree.
It's an interesting thing to watch. Well, we are pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today on our Links blog. You can find that under both the Programs tab on KBIA.org and the Podcast tab. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonKBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, to leave us comments, questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. And a quick reminder that today marked the start of KBIA's spring membership drive. If you're listening in the mornings, you'll hear Mike and me asking you to support the programming you hear on KBIA. If you're interested in making your pledge right now, you can do that online. Log on to KBIA.org, and you qualify for all of the same thank you gifts you'd get if you gave us a call over the phone. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. Join us again next week for another edition of Views of the News.